Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Hey, we're actually off. Oh my God. We were just saying we might be off soon, and then we are off. Oh my God. You couldn't write it. Oh God. Okay, we're off. Nick, your mic is too loud. Well, I literally said, just before we started, is everything all right with my mic? And then all of a sudden, where the fan mail's meant to be, is people saying, I wasn't shouting then. I was fucking doing my fucking best. How about now? Is it all right? Is it too loud? Too loud?
Apparently. It seems to be all right. This is good. That is good, it says.
I've just turned a knob. All in a day's work. So we're off. We are off. Like week old sushi. We're off. Here we go. So my name is Nick. This is
Nathaniel Metcalf.
And Nathaniel, no, you're having a go at me because I'm too loud. But Nathaniel is fucking around with the lead on his microphone.
I am. I keep doing that. It's a comfort mechanism because I must feel uncomfortable. Stop fondling with my mic. I won't. It's very sensitive. I've got a very sensitive mic now.
Is that it? I mean, you cannot be midway through what sounds like a sentence and then take a sip and then just leave it there. It's like a relay runner.
This is what the show, you've just done that now. You're taking a sip now.
Oh,
left a sentence after you've had a big
sip. Well, now that we've located the problem, it's going to keep popping up, I imagine, as it's wont to. This is the new normal.
It's what it is. It's a kind of free-form radio, this. This is the kind of thing no one's ever heard before. This is like Christian Slater in Pump Up the Volume. It's blowing people's minds. People don't normally stop in the middle of a sentence and have a sip of coffee. We're like Happy Harry Hardon, as he called, from Pump Up the Volume.
I've not seen Pump Up the Volume.
You've not seen it?
That was during a spate of Christian Slater movies that were neither on TV or were aimed at me. Do you know what I mean? I wasn't interested in watching. I think I'd seen Heathers.
Yeah, I think of it as one of his, like, certainly early days Slater movie.
It was peak Slater.
Peak Slater.
It was sort of like, he'd done Heathers, and then there was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and obviously, I mean, Star Trek VI. But then he gave, like, the 1-2 punch of Cuffs, Pump Up the Volume, Mobsters. Was in the Mobsters, and he was like teenage Nicholson, wasn't he?
That's exactly kind of... that was how he. And actually, when you watch the more, like, people said that at the time, oh, he's like Nicholson. And then when you watch Heathers now, you watch it and go, oh, he's basically just doing a Jack Nicholson impression. So that's why people have said that. It's obviously just what he's doing.
Also, when you actually watch Nicholson, Nicholson doesn't even become Nicholson until sort of like mid to late 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a bit of it in The Shining, and then by the time he gets to Witches of Eastwick, he's just like, who gives a fuck? I'll just do it with my eyebrows. But before then, he's not doing kind of like the things that you think that you... So I think
The Shining is, yeah, the start of it for him, and he never really lets it go after that. I think that's his whole shtick.
Well, people loved it. People loved it. I mean, there's little bits of it. I found out that he did The Last Detail. He turned down. What did he turn down to do The Last Detail?
I don't know.
He turned down.
71, 72.
Godfather. He said you should get an Italian-American to do this. And he looked at his lines and... He looked at his scenes. He didn't have any scenes with Marlon Brando. And he figured, I'll probably get to work with Marlon Brando once. And if it's not The Godfather, then... if I do The Godfather, then I won't actually be in any scenes with him. So you should get someone else for that. And then he did. And he said, and I thought The Last Detail was just as good. And he said that he'd not seen anything like The Last Detail. But, you know, he was kind of like, yeah. I mean, The Godfather's a classic, but The Last Detail is too. So he didn't have any regrets. And he was, and I think he was basically saying that he was really badly miscast.
So there you go. When you see him in as a young man in films in the 60s, he's got that really old face. So even when he's meant to be playing like teenagers or young people, he kind of just looks much older. And it sort of, he kind of grew into his face a bit, didn't he?
Yes. And his career. Like all of those Roger Corman movies that he did. And, you know, he was a writer. He started off in the animation department because, I mean, I watched a compilation of Jack Nicholson interviews, basically. And he was just like saying that he worked in the animation department. I can't remember which company. I imagine it was Disney, but it may not have been. And he worked in the animation department because he just wanted to be in Hollywood. He was starstruck. And then, this is him in like the 80s. It's like, or maybe like early 80s, late 70s. And he goes, oh, I was starstruck. I still am.
Oh, that's quite sweet.
I think that when you actually look at the... I love Jack Nicholson. I've always loved Jack Nicholson, but I've sort of underestimated how good he is as actually just a plain old actor.
Mm.
And when you watch stuff like The Last Detail where he's acting, he's so good as just sort of like a guy. With not Jack Nicholson doing all the Jack Nicholson stuff, but just as a guy. Yeah, oh, it's great. And then on top of that, he's Jack Nicholson. So the bits of that come in. Yeah, he's really great. And so, like, I saw, what was the Adam Sandler film?
Anger Management.
Anger Management. So I saw that. And that's such a weird film because you think you know what the film is going in, and then they just refuse to make that film. And you just... you go, this film would be much better if you just make the film that we think you're going to make. Adam Sandler gets angry and has to attend anger management classes, or he's mislabeled with anger issues, gets assigned an anger therapist, and the anger therapist makes him even more angry.
Mm.
And it's Jack Nicholson, and he drives him crazy. That's the film, right?
And Jack Nicholson is one of those people who playing that part would feel like he's an actor that you know is always, because of his back catalogue, he's always on the verge of going, blowing up. So it has a sense of threat.
You're taking all the baggage that Jack Nicholson has with you, and you're basically paying for that. But the film is not that. The film is... this really weird, convoluted... It's like they've come up with lots of scenarios on how to make anger management. It's like, all right, so we're going to do the buddy system where we buddy up. So you get an angry person and you get an angry person. So he gets buddied up with John Turturro. And John Turturro has a couple of scenes. And you go, well, that's the film, right? He's got anger issues, but not really. And then he gets partnered up with a guy that's really got anger issues. And then you go, well, no, that doesn't happen in the film. There's two scenes of it, but that's not the film. Okay, so Jack Nicholson is his anger therapist. And then they're going to drive each other mad. No, that doesn't happen because it's sort of, they introduce it as an idea, but it doesn't really happen that way. Okay, so he does group therapy. It's not one-on-one therapy, but there's group therapy. Yeah, there's group therapy sessions. So it's all about like... The therapy sessions, and then they all go off and they do the dream team. So no, they don't do that. There's like a couple of scenes there because we've got some jokes about it, and John McEnroe is going to do a cameo, but it's not really that. So what is it? Well, it's kind of all of that, but then we've got it's like the game as well, where it's all a trick, and it's just such a mental film when you watch it. And you kind of like go, why is this so fucking complicated? There's like four or five. It's like what they did was they went, right, my name's Adam Sandler, and my next project is going to be based around anger management. We've got a title. It's called Anger Management. And we've even got a star. Jack Nicholson says he's interested. So Robert De Niro started doing comedies. So Jack Nicholson is going to take a stab at it, and he's going to see what it's like to make a comedy in the modern age. Great. Yeah. Brilliant. So we've got a star, we've got a title. What are we going to do? And they all sit down, him and his writers, and they all sit down and they do a thought shower. Is that what you call it? They all do like a spider diagram of all of the different things that could be like, oh, well, there's like, well, they can have a buddy system where he's got a really angry guy and he goes to group therapy and he's got this crazy therapist played by Jack Nicholson and he upsets a Buddhist monk and he shouts on a plane and everyone thinks that he's angrier than he really is and he's got to win his girlfriend back and, you know, and they, and that was the first day of writing and then they just wrote it. And they didn't pick a film, they didn't pick a story, they just make loads of complicated, and you just
think that's interesting. I'm trying to think of other examples, but I think you're right. There are loads of films that from a poster or a video box or something, you would go, "Oh right, yeah, I know what that film is," and you go and see it, and it isn't the thing that you just that you've already got the film sort of, and what you really want to do is just watch that film that you've that it's been sold to you as. And yeah, I think it like the poster for it was like exactly. You looked at it and went, "Oh, it's basically Analyze This, but with Jack Nicholson in it." You know, it's basically doing that, isn't it? With a different kind of a different setup, but it's basically Adam Sandler and Jack Nicholson's version of Analyze This.
Adam Sandler, famous for losing it on screen, so you know, even on something that's kind of like The Wedding Singer, they kind of work out a way to kind of like go, "Oh, it's because of emotional issues." And he loses it a couple of times. You go, "That's right." And that's what he does. That's his famous thing. He did it on his albums. He did it in his first few films. Great. Brilliant. You got a comedy actor at the height. You know, Wedding Singer and Waterboy came out in the same year. You go, fucking hell, that's incredible. 1998, I think. Came out the same year. And so he's got this character. He's got his comedy persona is a guy that loses it. And you got Jack Nicholson, same. After The Shining, it's like he's the guy who fucking loses it, but he's a proper actor. And now we're going to team them up, two guys that are famous for losing it in a film. And it's not that. So just like, exactly, make the fucking film I've got in my head that you sold me.
But again, it's a thing where Jack Nicholson always feels like he's quite precious about the parts he plays. And even something like Batman, which I'm sure he did for the most part because he had such a huge payout. But even something like that feels like that's cashing in on his back catalogue and being like, "Yep, I'm going to do a full-on Jack Nicholson performance in this. It's what everyone wants," and he does it. But for the most part, he's basically retired now. And even pre and post Batman, he never felt like he was being bought in, you know, he never felt like he was just doing something just to do it. It always felt like it was kind of quite a quality project, or there was like, or it felt like, you know, or he felt like a star in as much as like, if he's in it, it's a big movie.
Well, he's an actor. And I think that is something that you forget because he's Jack Nicholson. And it's easy to forget that he's an actor. So when you go back and you watch his things and he has sort of like subtle performances and he's not doing all the big Jack Nicholson stuff, you kind of like go, oh yeah, he does all this stuff as well. And then when you do, I don't think he pushes it as far as he could as the Joker. And I also, I don't know how much I love Batman. I do like Batman Returns, but,
I think
Batman is flawed. You saw them recently?
Yeah, I saw them recently back to back at cinema, probably, I guess, a little bit before the pandemic. And I watched the first Batman film and I was a bit like, "Oh, it really doesn't hold up." And I almost went home in the break between Batman Returns because I was a bit like, "I don't know if I fancy doing another 2 hours of a film I don't really like." But went back for Batman Returns, and Batman Returns is the opposite. It's like brilliant film. Still absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. It's, I think giving Tim Burton free rein on that one really pays off. Gotham looks better, even though it's like a tiny soundstage when you look back at it. Gotham looks better, and Danny DeVito's great, and the origin story of Catwoman is brilliant. It's all made up. Do you know what I mean? That's not what the Penguin's meant to be like, and that's not what Catwoman's meant to be like. And people are so precious these days. But it was like literally Tim Burton's interpretation of the material. And you wouldn't be able to do that now.
Hmm.
Or even Zack Snyder did his like interpretation of the material, and that was like, no. You know what I mean? People like half the people hated it, and half the people loved it so much that you know it became kind of violent.
It's also it's a film, isn't it? Which is the thing that people forget now, that it is someone who's gone, can you make a film of Batman, where it's almost now, I think the object is like, can you make a film that is sort of like the comics, but you can't actually, you know, but everyone has a different idea of what the comics are anyway. So you'll never please everyone. But what we want you to do is please everyone. That's what we need.
Can you compress 50 years of comic lore into a movie?
And that's not what diverge at all from
that's
these.
What I think Marvel has done incredibly well. It makes you feel like there was only ever one comic book and that was what you were reading. You know, it sort of like almost discounts all of the changes that comics have gone through, all of the different illustrators and writers, and it just makes it all feel like this is what it is, which is sort of like its biggest success and probably why I'm not such a huge fan, because they all feel slightly generic.
I think that's right. I think traditionally Marvel as a comics publisher have kind of kept a fairly consistent universe, whereas DC have constantly rebooted their universes and had different versions of. So it actually, in a way, what they're doing now, or what they were doing, I don't know if they changed their mind, by just having everything in its own universe, kind of makes more sense for DC stuff. It's almost like you don't really have to bother doing a coherent universe. You might as well just get different people to do different versions of it.
I mean, I appreciate that they do comic books where Superman and Batman are side by side, but I equally am absolutely fine watching a Batman film that is in an isolated universe.
Sure, yeah.
It's kind of like, when you look at it, it's kind of like, what is Batman actually thinking? You know, it's like you're a man and you live in a world where there are aliens. Why don't you spend your money on, improving street safety? Were we talking about this? You know, put some more lights up, put some more street lights up. Is there like a really fucked up area? Yeah. Pay for some more police.
Crime Alley, where my parents were murdered. I'll tell you what, put a bit of money in and maybe get a bit of CCTV up there.
Get some CCTV up there. Do you know what I mean? It's just like you're a billionaire. You're living in a universe where Superman exists, where Wonder Woman is a fucking, Athenian god. And you're a man that does push-ups and you're going, yeah, I'll join in. And everyone's like, oh, mate, this is a bit awkward. You do have a lot of money, though. Why don't you put all of that money into kind of like, like a scheme where you're teaching criminals new skills so that they can go into business for themselves?
What have you done this week, Bruce? Well, I've basically funded like a taxi service that can make kind of, if there's sort of lone women coming back from clubs, and they basically a free taxi service that I'll pay for and they can get home safe. Oh, well done, mate. You've done, that's like a great idea. No problem. I'm rich. It doesn't really, it's fine with me because I don't even miss the money. I'm a billionaire.
You're like a real life superhero, aren't you? Oh, I wouldn't say that, but but thanks. You know what I mean? It's like Bruce Wayne. And then it's also kind of like when I was watching, one of the things I was noticed about Superman is like, why the fuck is he so muscly? It's like, what's he benching? Do you know what I mean? Superman, Superman should be an absolute weed, right? Or Superman should look like us, right?
Yeah.
Where he's just sort of like the stronger. He comes from an alien planet and he comes down to Earth and he is just as muscly as Batman, right? And you kind of like an Aquaman. They're all really muscly. Yeah, they have to be because they're like on Earth.
It's Superman. One of the things in the Zack Snyder universe of Superman films. The fact when he's just as Clark Kent walking about in a t-shirt and he's massive, I do go, I mean, it. You look like you can put someone through a wall anyway. Like, it doesn't, there's no sort of sense of Superman being super. Whereas I think the great thing about Christopher Reeve was he was just a very tall, quite broad man. So he was quite a big guy. So it kind of made sense when he's Superman, but it also makes sense that when he's Clark Kent, he just looks a bit awkward because he's a bit tall and a bit kind of, you know, gawky. It's sort of perfect.
Superman should absolutely not have veins bulging through his muscles. Do you know what I mean? It's like you go, you're Superman. Maybe on your home planet when you were lifting something that was heavy, but on Earth, nothing is heavy. So... what, how are you maintaining those muscles? You should just be like a regular guy that can lift stuff up.
Yeah.
So I think we've torn the DC universe a new one. I don't think Batman and Superman deserve to, I don't think it matters if they're in the same universe. And I think what's good about Marvel is they've created this universe. But even at the beginning, it was like Iron Man, and then they were like, and now we're doing Thor. And it was like, Thor? But you've just created this real-world Iron Man thing. How does Thor? And then when they started adding all these fantastical elements to it, you go, yeah, cool. But at first, it was a little bit of a stretch. I don't know. I don't really care about any of these films. Jack Nicholson... is a great actor. Anger Management is a weird film. But he also did like little comedies. And he did films that were just kind of... I guess he did films where...
I mean, he did films that were comedies, but they were always like almost like prestige comedies, right? He's in Broadcast News and he's in those James L. Brooks films, isn't he?
Yeah.
But they're kind of prestige comedies, aren't they? They're like, they're comedies that probably get Oscar-nominated screenplays and things.
Yes, sure. But he also did, like, Man Trouble with Ellen Barkin, you know what I mean? So it's kind of... And Wolf, whereas you get the impression with Wolf that they were just like, it's a werewolf film and we're going to put Jack Nicholson in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was like, that's the casting, right? That's what we do. Heartburn. Have you ever seen Heartburn?
No. He's retired now, isn't he, Nicholson? He's part... And Gene Hackman. I just find it a bit frustrating sometimes when you go, you've got these two kind of great American actors who have both kind of gone... I mean, they've earned the right to retire like anyone does. But like, I do find it sometimes where you go, they're both still knocking about, but they've both gone, I've sort of done it all now. They both feel that they've kind of played everything they want to do.
Gene Hackman retired in something like 2003.
Mm.
His last film was Welcome to Mooseport, starring Ray Romano. and I like Ray Romano, but that was meant to be a terrible film that nobody went to see. And Gene Hackman was just like, nah. And now he writes cowboy books.
Oh, I like that idea, though.
So he's sort of like a novelist now. Jack Nicholson, I don't know what Jack Nicholson does. He plays golf, I guess.
I know he's good mate still with Bruce Stern, isn't he? Which I quite like as a... idea as well, so they both hang out together.
Well, that was nice. That's one of the nice things about Anger Management is that Harry Dean Stanton turns up and you're kind of like, oh, there you go, because they were best mates. And yeah, I know I had something else to say about Jack Nicholson, but I can't remember what it was. Anyway, tell your friends if you're enjoying this. You're listening to Fan Club. My name's Nick, this is Nathaniel
McGough,
and this is this week's Fan Club. It was your birthday last week.
It's my birthday last week, yeah.
And you've had a fucking birthday haircut.
I did, and on my birthday itself, which is quite nice.
Was it a treat?
Was weird, though. Like, I quite like the idea of having a haircut. I wanted to get my hair cut.
It looks great. You posted that picture of Tony Blair.
Oh, yeah.
And you were like, is this what, and when you put the picture up, it was like, yeah. It's kind of like, it is that. It's that long...
During lockdown one, my hair sort of grew that by the end, just before I got a haircut, I had the same hair that Joaquin Phoenix has in the Joker film. And I was like, it looks like that's what I'm doing. It's too close to the film coming out. Like, I feel like I've got that hair suddenly. So I'm quite glad to get it cut. It's a weird thing, though. You are like holding a mask over your face, which you're sort of going, this doesn't do anything. Do you know what I mean? I totally understand why we're doing it. But it's almost as soon as you've got to take the things off from behind your ears and you're basically holding a mask like that over your face, you just think, who is this helping, really? Like, I mean, what who are we protecting now? It's just sort of like the pretense of it. Like, I mean, I guess you've just got to at that point go, you almost want to apologize to the guy and go, well, I hope I don't have COVID and I hope you don't. And that's all we can do at this point, because this isn't doing anything. So it's quite a weird thing. I think the last haircut I had, though, was dreadful. And I don't even think they did sort of cut the sides of my hair very well. And I had a big floppy bit of hair on one side where it wasn't cut properly. But I can understand it's difficult. It's difficult to try and cut hair when people have got masks around their ears.
And maybe some of
these must be a nightmare.
Maybe some of these people weren't hairdressers going into lockdown, you know? Do you know what I mean?
Funny thing to have taken up, though, during lockdown one. Come out of this, going to live my dream and be a hairdresser.
No, you've got all your life, haven't you, to learn how to cut people's hair. All on lockdown, you know?
I quite like the idea of being able to cut hair, actually. It's probably quite a nice skill.
I used to cut my own hair. I cut my own hair for years and years and years.
Did you?
And then I had a girlfriend that was cut hair. She did hair and makeup on TV. So she cut my hair, and then we split up. And then I cut my own hair. And then she saw that I'd cut my own hair. That was the thing that got us back in contact again. It was like, you're not going out like that, are you? So then she came over and cut my hair again. And you go, oh, that's a nice way of kind of being friends. Yeah. But yeah, I like cutting my own hair. I haven't cut my own hair in a while, though. I feel a little bit like, but what if I need long hair? But I'm also thinking, what if I go bald and this is my last chance to enjoy having short hair?
I feel like that all the time. But I think often when my hair's long, I notice things like, as it would do naturally, I notice more like hair in a plug hole. So I decide, oh, I'm going bald. This is the end. And I get my hair cut and then go, no, there's just less hair now. Because I guess it's less likely to drop out.
Hair drops out. And I don't know. I don't brush my hair. I just So every so often, I will brush my hair once every 8 weeks. Not 2 months, 8 weeks. I'll brush my hair and all sorts of fucking hair will be like being yanked out of my fucking head. It's normal to shed between 50 and 100 hairs a day. I don't doubt it.
I guess, but there's a lot of it in there. I haven't counted, but I've got a few of them.
Oh, you don't look like you're going bald, mate.
Good.
But I don't want to. Jack Nicholson's last film was How Do You Know in 2010.
Don't even know what that is.
I think that was a James L. Brooks film, and I think it had like Owen Wilson and Reese Witherspoon and
Paul
Rudd here, and I think it was one of the biggest flops of all time. And then I guess you get to a point where you go, I've done Chinatown, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, I've been the Joker, I've been Hoffa, I've been in an Adam Sandler film, I've done everything that I need to do, I should just stop having to get up early in the morning and, It was a box office bomb, grossing $49 million against a $120 million budget. Yeah, but I'd hope that it wasn't the film not doing well that made him go, I'm not going to do it anymore.
Yeah. Like, also, that's a
the public have spoken.
Film for a comedy, right?
Yes, but you've got Paul Rudd, Jack Nicholson, Reese Witherspoon, Owen Wilson. So
that's
what?
Your budget gone.
So is Jack Nicholson what? He's getting 10 million straight off the top? Yeah. Or is he getting 20 million straight off the top just by being in it? Like half of that is on salaries. It's on stars. You know?
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
And it would have cost more than that as well with marketing. Oh, God, it's really annoying me. I can't remember what it is, but we've got a song to play every week.
We can play a song and maybe it'll come back to us.
The combined salaries for the director and the four major stars, Nicholson, Wilson, Rudd,
and Witherspoon. About 50 million.
Yeah, that's almost what I said.
More than Nicholson at the time. Interesting.
That's what I said, isn't it? But I think Nicholson was probably a cameo and it was Witherspoon's film. I think you would, you got Reese Witherspoon and then she's the star and then you got Nicholson in like four scenes.
And that's right for 12 million.
Sprinkle him throughout and then you got 12 million. All right, let's play a song and then let's talk about something. Because Lord knows we haven't yet.
And Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back. Apparently the Charlie Sheen TV series Anger Management was based on the movie Anger Management, but I thought that they were just unrelated with the same title. That's what I thought.
I wasn't even aware they'd done a TV show with
Charlie Sheen. It's like when he left Two and a Half Men, he went off to do, well, I guess he got offered Anger Management. I guess it was literally, oh, he's free. And then they jumped on him and they were like, if we get Charlie Sheen in our sitcom, then we're going to get at least another season out of this, right?
Yeah. I mean, at that time, he'd sort of become the biggest star off Two and a Half Men. It's such a show I've got no time for at all. But it's massively popular, wasn't it?
I think it's one of the worst films, TV shows. I think it's disgusting. I thought it was disgusting. I thought everyone came out of that looking bad. Not the actors, but it was just like men, women, the level of the jokes, and I mean, it made me feel, like a Christian. I was like, do you know what I mean? I was like very anti Two and a Half Men. I was like, fuck you. you know, I thought everyone just came out of it so, it was such a bleak, depressing sitcom, so sort of like cynical, and oh yeah, it just made me miserable watching it, so I didn't. And but like everything, yeah, anyway, let's not bother. Let's not bother. Oh, right. Okay. So, what have I been a fan of this week? Tell you what I saw this week.
Yeah.
I saw Citizen Kane for the first time.
Oh, yeah. Never seen it.
I have obviously tried to see it. So there's a few films. That 2001, A Space Odyssey, never got through. I think I've probably seen all of 2001, just not all in one go. Citizen Kane, I felt like I'd seen it. It's just, I just can't. You're told that they're good. Yeah, obviously it was regarded as the best film ever made for many years, until fairly recently when they officially titled Vertigo the best film ever made. I don't have a problem watching Vertigo. I could watch that over and over again. Mm. Citizen Kane is just one of those. Like, even Citizen Kane, the TV was on, and it was on BBC Two on Saturday, and it's at 2:30. They said Citizen Kane is now on BBC, and I paused it. I paused the TV and I just tweeted, right, Citizen Kane's on BBC Two. I'm going to watch it. And people liked my tweet. I'd had a few interactions with the tweet. Some 45 minutes had passed and I looked up and it was still paused because I hadn't bothered watching it. I just had the glory of saying that I was going to watch it. And then I didn't. And then, like, that evening, people would messaged and said, well, what did you think of it? And it's like, I didn't watch it. Like, and then I felt like, oh, well, I've got to watch it. It can't be one of them people that's just posing and saying that you're gonna watch Citizen Kane and then you don't watch Citizen Kane. It can't be one of those people that says they're gonna watch Citizen Kane and then doesn't watch Citizen Kane. So I watched it. Yeah, I've seen it. Have you seen it?
Yeah, and I saw it, I think, when I was a teenager, and I was struck by, like, I think it's a really watchable film, and it was, I think I went into it expecting to watch something difficult, and I found it really watchable, and I love all the kind of performances in it, and I've got a real soft spot for Joseph Cotton anyway in things, especially yeah. when he's like the lead. I think he's such an interesting, weird leading man.
So, but what do you know Joseph Cotton from?
Like, almost like when you see him in like horror films, and when he's in like The Third Man, and he seems to pop up. And he was in like Heaven's Gate and things.
Well, like, quite much later on,
when he's like a kind of character actor, and it's interesting to see those guys in when they're actually stars. You know, they're the sort of leading man.
Yes,
and actually, I mean, I saw quite unusual as well. He doesn't strike me as like super good looking or anything. He's got a sort of quite a sinister air to him.
Well, he can be either, can't he?
Mm.
He was in, but I think he was mainly used for sinister stuff, wasn't he? Mm. He was
Shadow of a Doubt.
Shadow of a Doubt. Okay, so I saw Niagara recently, which was great. Have you seen Niagara, the Marilyn Monroe movie? Oh, it's brilliant. The scenery, I mean, Niagara is one of those films where they film it in and around Niagara Falls, and they've literally gone, half the budget is, or half the film is, all we need to do is just film Niagara Falls. Like, we need to just do the best shots we can, like, of the waterfalls, of the architecture, of just all the surrounding. You know, you film like the area around Niagara Falls, and we've got all of our monies on screen. Plus, we've got Marilyn Monroe, so we film and she's playing a bad guy, and it's just sort of like it's not like got the best story, and it's not got the best pacing to it. But as one of those films that sort of like just, you know, drizzles over you as you're watching it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I think Niagara Falls was just this great film. And Joseph Cotton's in that. And he's also in Shadow of a Doubt, which, when you take away Psycho, Vertigo, North by Northwest, when you take away kind of like the big ones, you know, the big, the cliches, yeah?
The big Hitchcocks.
It's like Shadow of a Doubt might be one of my favourites, might be... Psycho is one of my favorite films. North by Northwest is one of the greatest films ever made. I love Vertigo. I love these films. Shadow of a Doubt. Oh, it's such a fucking good one. It's early as well.
Yeah.
He made it like a couple of years after Citizen Kane. So 43 or 44, maybe 42, but early.
Increasingly, I just think, he's probably just quite good, this guy. He just makes good films.
Who? Joseph Cotten, Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Well, his films are good, and even something like Family Plot is still watchable. Even though, if you watch it in the context of other Hitchcock films, you go, "It's great." If you watch it in the context of what else was being made at the time, you kind of like go, "Whoa," because I think Family Plot came out around the same time as Bullet, didn't it?
Right, that
and Bullet was doing all these amazing car chases, and then he's still using like rear projection and all this other stuff. So, so I think Hitchcock is probably the greatest director that ever lived, and there's so much you can get off those. But like when you watch the ones that aren't the big hitters, like Shadow of Doubt. I didn't really like, what's the Man Who Knew Too Much?
I like that a lot. No, I've got a lot of time for it.
I didn't really.
Family Plot is one I can't really get into. I'm a big fan of Frenzy, but I know people don't like it. And I really like Frenzy. And that's a very late one. It's the one. Whereas I think Family Plot does feel a bit plodding to me. It's just a bit like, if it stopped one film earlier, I would have been like, yeah, good for you, man. That's great.
Family Plot was very much like a pilot for the Alfred Hitchcock series, though, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah.
And it feels like that. But I still enjoyed it when I watched it. But it's not in the same league as the big ones. But what is in the same league as the big ones is Shadow of Doubt. But also, so what's the other one I watched? Strangers on the Train, which has got a more famous title, I would say, than it does. Film. I'd say more people have heard of it than they have seen it. And oh my god, it's good. Like so that's that. So Joseph Cotten, yes, so that's how you know Joseph Cotten. Keep talking to me about Citizen Kane, please.
Well, I liked Citizen Kane from that point on and found it very watchable, but I've never had that thing where I didn't watch it and go, well, that's one of my favorite films. What I watched it doing was I found myself going, I found it very watchable, which I think is a positive thing. But then the main thing I did after that was go, oh, that's quite clever. Oh, I like what they did there. That's quite smart. And at the end of it, it was like a watchable film. And I think that's the difference between something like that and a Hitchcock film, which has a similar thing where you're really aware of what he's doing all the time. You're really aware that you're being pulled in all these different directions and the camera's making you think one thing and it's showing you another, and it's doing all that, but it's less, it's almost, there's a bit of Citizen Kane which feels a bit like it's like someone saying, by the way, I'm doing something quite clever now. And it is watchable and it's very like, it's an entertaining film, but I've never loved it in the way that I love a lot of movies. But I would also say that I've never found it difficult to watch. It's, and I've watched it a few times because it's like, yeah, I can watch that again. It's never been something that I thought was like eating my greens or anything like that. I think it also works as quite a decent kind of just proper movie that's an easy enough watch.
What I would say you notice is it's like the blueprint of how to do a biopic. Mm. You know, where it's kind of like it could be Sid and Nancy, or it could be Walk the Line. You know, it's like there's a guy and he has success and then he loses his success, and it's kind of like you go, oh yeah, that's how you do it. And there's some amazing shots in it. I enjoyed it, right? And I haven't stopped thinking about it since I watched it. The difference between him and Hitchcock, and Hitchcock was making films around that same time.
Yeah.
But yet to do kind of like the really big stuff.
Have you ever seen Touch of Evil?
No, but I'm familiar with the soundtrack to it because it was on a CD I had when I was a teenager called This Is Cult Fiction.
Right.
And it was like all Tarantino-inspired stuff. And then you'd have like the theme tune from Joe 90 on there and the theme tune from Touch of Evil. And the theme tune from Touch of Evil is great. I think it's going to be my next thing is to sort of like sit through and watch some awesome Well stuff.
Yeah, I haven't seen a great deal. And the stuff I have seen, I saw Lady from Shanghai recently and I was a bit...
Oh, really? Because that was going to be a William Castle film. There was kind of...
Yeah.
William Castle... Oh, because did you read the book?
Yeah, yeah. He was going to... That was his thing that he wanted to... And did he actually... Didn't Wells kind of do the dirty on him a bit?
Yeah, Wells... William Castle... There's this book that me and Nat have read about William Castle. I can't remember what it's called, but Google it. There's not many books about him. William Castle, brilliant. It's a great book. It's a great fucking book. He self-penned it, but then he also wrote like an epilogue for after he died, an appendices, and so it's sort of like it's printed from beyond the grave. It's funny, but William Castle basically put all of the stuff together for this project that he could make with Orson Welles, and Orson Welles sort of like elbowed him out and took over. I think he's still a producer. And a similar thing happened with Rosemary's Baby and Polanski, where William Castle wanted to direct it. It was like he shot at legitimacy because he was doing films like The Tingler and House on Haunted Hill and 13 Ghosts and stuff like that. Where, what was that Joan Crawford film that he did? Maniac, was that what it was called?
Yes, yeah, Maniac, I think.
And so he did sort of like exploitation films, basically, that had gimmicks to get you into the cinema. If you've ever seen the John Goodman film Matinee, basically that's kind of a tribute to William Castle. And he really wanted to be legitimate, and Roman Polanski and Orson Welles both fucked him over, really. But I think he's got a cameo in Rosemary's Baby. And he's still friends with Orson Welles. He doesn't take it badly.
No.
He's sort of like a very upbeat, beautiful personality, really, that comes across. God, I love William Castle. He was like the low-rent Hitchcock.
Yeah, and I think he probably acknowledges as well that he probably would have ended up making a lot more money out of Rosemary's Baby than he would have done were it a William Castle film.
Yes, and I think he would have done something. They went art house with Rosemary's Baby, and he would have done something else. So I haven't seen Lady in Shanghai. I've seen The Third Man. I've seen more interviews with Orson Welles than I have films, and I'm interested. And it's like later on when they did like Rod Steiger and Christopher Plummer did Waterloo. They needed someone to be the King of France, and you go, yeah, we'll get Orson Welles to come out and do the King of France. So it's kind of like he was like a living legend. I think Citizen Kane is a great film. I really did like it. I had to stop it. I had to keep checking the time. It felt a very long film. It's 2 hours. It felt much longer. And I had to watch the entire series of Line of Duty Series 6 in one day on Sunday. I'd like binge watch the entire thing because my girlfriend wanted to. We have put it off. And then it was the last series and she was like, I want to be part of the general public for tonight. And I was like, okay, so we binge watched it all. That felt like an easier job than watching Citizen Kane in some places. Technically, you're watching it going, that's fucking incredible. You need to know before you watch it how none of this existed beforehand, or how it wasn't really, having kind of like the focus so that it was in focus in the back and in focus in the foreground and the background at the same time. That was sort of like a technique that was used, but not loads. And he really kind of did a lot of it.
There are definite bits in it where you are a bit like, I don't really know how you've done that. Like, yeah. I still don't know. And presumably there was people literally pulling sets apart while they were filming.
Yeah. So the bit when the camera goes through the sign, a neon sign, the sign split apart. And Hitchcock was doing stuff like that when a camera has to go through a door he'd always cheat stuff, like they would open the door and the camera would go through the door, and then the actor would mime closing the door, but he couldn't actually close the door because the camera was going through the door, and then the whole front of the house would split in half, and then the whole crew would go through, and then it would go into the house. You go, yeah, it's amazing shots. The best shot in Citizen Kane, I think, is when he's a child playing in the snow outside, and they're watching him at the window, and then it all comes through, and then the woman signs him away to the adoption house, and then it goes back to the window, and then you see him, and all the way through you just see him in focus outside playing in the garden. That's an incredible shot. There's some incredible stuff in Citizen Kane. What I would say is I'm not really interested in the story, and what Hitchcock is great at is he is not afraid to be kind of lowbrow or populist. I think Citizen Kane is about a newspaper, a billionaire, magnate. When you watch it, we were basically talking after we saw it, and we were saying that there's sort of like a lot of very relevant things in Citizen Kane, all about like how whoever owns the media controls the media. And we're looking at a thing where Disney are buying more and more media houses and production companies, and Rupert Murdoch owns like all the newspapers, and so you have very few people that are in control of all the information. And Citizen Kane was saying that in 1941. It's kind of like this very sort of like interesting film when you watch it. They say something about someone getting cancelled, and that's not even where that came from. That's not where your cancelled comes from, cancel culture, but they mention it in Citizen Kane. It's kind of, so it feels very relevant and very sort of like modern in places. The camera work is incredible. Technically, it's great. But what it doesn't have is it doesn't have that kind of like wound up toy car thing that Hitchcock has, where he'll tell you, you're in a safe pair of hands, this is going to be a lot of fun. And then he lets the car go and you watch it go. And all of this technical stuff is attached to a story that is worth telling. Whereas Citizen Kane is kind of like an exercise in filmmaking. And you kind of like go, yeah, it's great. And the way it, but it feels more like a bit of an exercise, I think.
I think that's spot on. I think that's like a really good, like, I think I watched Citizen Kane at the time when I'd be a teenager, so I was becoming more and more interested in making films. So you kind of watch it in that way. Whereas I was watching Hitchcock films when I was a kid, like To Catch a Thief or something. And before you notice anything that's sort of clever about it, you're just watching like a potboiler. You know, you're watching a proper... So as a kid, you like those movies because they're still exciting and things. And it's when you watch them again, you go, oh God, that's clever. I never picked up on that before. And how that's been put together and is clever. And that's why you think like that while you're watching.
And obviously, you know, all of his films have like these incredible central performances that are really engaging, that help you forget about the mechanics. You know, you're watching James Stewart. You can watch James Stewart in anything. You can watch Cary Grant in anything. Anthony Perkins is just absolutely fantastic in Psycho. Yeah. So you're watching these performances where you go, and you've got this fucking incredible plot. And on top of that, it's just technically, whereas Citizen Kane, great performances. That's one thing that's going on. Great technical stuff. That's another thing. The story is okay. I watched Troll 2 as well. Troll 2, which is widely regarded as the Citizen Kane of bad movies. It's the worst film ever made. I probably enjoyed watching Troll 2 more than I enjoyed watching Citizen Kane. But Citizen Kane, without a doubt, is the best. Casablanca was made around about the same time. And I would say, you know, Casablanca is... Like we've said in the past, Casablanca's got one of these very kind of like sentimental movie plots. You know, the dialogue is kind of like, it's not real dialogue, but it's the sort of dialogue that you feel only exists in movies. And it's because of Casablanca that you have dialogue like that. That sort of movie dialogue that you get in Casablanca that's quotable and all this other stuff, you know. When you watch Casablanca, you feel like you are watching, this is how you do it, guys. And it's the same thing with Citizen Kane, but on a more technical level. And I, you know, if I had to pick, I would definitely say Casablanca is the greatest film of all time. If you're going to be like a film snob and not count anything past 1960, then you'd go, well, Casablanca. I would say Casablanca over Vertigo. But the fact that Citizen Kane was there for so long, it's just like, are you watching this as a comfort film? Is this what you're watching, you know, on a sad day and you're feeling all a bit depressed and it's raining outside? Are you whacking on Casablanca and putting are you whacking on Citizen Kane and putting a blanket on and eating biscuits, watching it? No, you're absolutely not. You could do that with Casablanca, you know. Right, we're getting shouted out because we've got to do fan mail. So, are we number 203 in Estonia, Nat?
Oh, that's worse, isn't it? Isn't it? Well, is it better?
I don't know. We've got nothing to base that on, Natalie, because we've never had an Estonia before, have we? I guess it's good. All right, Brian. Ah, here we go. And now, Peter, I've been out of sorts for about 5 weeks now, I think. I've not felt myself in a while, but here we go. Ah, dear Nick and Nat, I started watching the new docuseries with Morgan Freeman called History of God. I'm not particularly a religious person, but I have to say that it's really good. I love Morgan Freeman. Have you watched it? Cheers, Danny. I'm guessing Morgan Freeman's doing the History of God because he is God.
Mm.
Is that right? He's the voice of God.
I've never even heard of this. I imagine it's probably about the history of gods and people who believe in gods, right? Could be quite interesting. Not heard of it, though.
No. Sure. No, I've not seen it. I hope that the next question's a bit spicier. Hey, Nick and Nat! How are you doing? I'm going to do it all joined up, right? Hey, Nick and Nat, how you doing, you lovely boys? I recently watched Emily in Paris, and I can see why French people are so pissed off with it. Have you heard about the whole controversy? Honestly, the storyline is just fucking stupid. Have you watched it? Holly. I've not seen it. I have heard of it.
No,
but I've not seen it.
I've not seen it. Is that what the controversy is? It's just a bit like a fake France or something? I don't know.
I've not seen any of the controversy.
No, neither.
Come on, guys. I've just binge watched the whole of season 6 of Line of Duty so that I can be part of the conversation. And now you're throwing all this stuff at me. It's awful. Here's a good watch for you, Nathaniel. Mm. I really was in the mood for watching some Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, yeah.
So I said Anthony Hopkins into my voice activated remote control. And it came up with a head-to-head or face-to-face. It's an interview series.
Oh, face-to-face, yes. From the 60s, is it?
This is from the 90s. I think it had a relaunch.
Okay.
But it was from the 60s. So I'm going to go back because they've got, like, Martin Luther King and all these, you know, like, historical figures. And then in the 90s, they did sort of, like, Anthony Hopkins, Adam Faith. So I'm going to go back. But the Anthony Hopkins one, I watched twice in one night. It's stunning.
Yeah, I might watch that then. Maybe we'll talk about that next week.
It's stunning. We'll talk about it next week. All right. Hello, boys. How are you? Now that the lockdown is going to be slightly lifted, what are your plans? Cheers, Fabian. I'm never leaving my flat again.
If you want to send us some fan mail, the fan club address is fanclub@fubarradio.com.
Yeah, and don't be like Danny, Holly, and Fabian. Try and write in something, you know, that's worth our time. Right, let's play a song.
We're going to play our guest's choice.
This is our guest's favourite song. Mm-hmm. You know who the guest is because you're clicking on a link saying this is who our guest is. But for people that are... Everyone knows who's like, okay, fine.
Unless
you're listening live, and maybe you don't know who the guest is. Sure. All right. Our next guest has got to own up to this monstrosity.
Bye. down to make me who loves you, like me crash into the ground. I am so lonely, you don't even know me, but you like to spoon me. Just enough in my own view, education to perform. I'd like to shoot you all. And then you go home with you on your own. What do you really know, Mr. Lady? Why don't you tell?
And Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back live in the studio. We're not in the studio. I'm in my spare room and Nat's in his washroom. And we're not live. We're pre-recorded. But aside from that, we absolutely are. And We're joined now live in the studio. I've just said we're not. By a TV presenter, actor, adventurer, basically, Charlie Borman. Hello, Charlie Borman. How are you?
Hey, very well, thank you. Yeah, and I'm sitting here in my living room, I suppose, with my dog.
What's your dog called?
A dog's called Woody.
Woody. Okay.
Woody, cool. Yeah, my kids named him. But you know, he's a lovely fella. He really is. He's partly poodle. So he's a sprudel.
Oh right.
If anyone's interested.
He just looks like a spaniel.
Not at all, you know. Anyway. But he's got his intelligence of his father. He doesn't do much.
So. we've just been listening to so this is your favourite song of all time. Is Mr. Yep. Writer by the Stereophonics?
Yes, yeah, it is. And no, I mean, it's interesting because when I don't know if people know what I did, or what I've done, but I suppose people know me most for riding around the world on a motorbike with Ewan McGregor. And when we were doing the first one, Long Way Round, when we went from London to New York, the Stereophonics was one of the bands that we listened to all the time, and then somehow we ended up going to there was a charity do and the Stereophonics were playing with the Who in the Albert Hall, and we met them afterwards, and Kelly had this script that he gave to Ewan, and he said, look, Ewan, will you read the script? And Ewan said, look, I'll read the script if you write the title song for Long Way Round. And so that's how we met them. And so somehow the Stereophonics has been in my life, or in our lives, since 2004 2005. So they wrote the theme tune to Long Way Round,
right? They were,
and then down them. and then recently we did Up. And so, but Kelly was saying, look, I'm going to do what I'm going to record is the Up bit. And so he just sort of just sliced it in, and he said it was really difficult because he had to match his voice from 12 years ago. And he said that, you know, he had this 12-year-old years ago voice that is not the same today. So anyway,
so he didn't re-record the entire track. He just said,
no, we just put it in. Well, a little bit more, you know, I think it was a little run into it.
But no, I do.
But more or less. So if you listen to it really carefully, you see this the long way herb.
That's great.
Like
that.
And do you know what became of his screenplay?
Of his screenplay, yeah, no, it was very good. But I don't know.
You don't know. Okay. We were going to say as well, like we always talk about favourite things on this, and your favourite film is The Shawshank Redemption. Why did you pick that?
Well, because I just thought if I chose one of my own, that would seem a bit kind of weird, wouldn't it?
If you were to pick one,
I tell you, I love that movie, and I remember I went to see it by mistake the first time. It was a slight slow burner when it first came out, and I went to go and see some other movie, but there were no tickets. Was full. So the guy said, I said, well, what's starting now? And they said, oh, this film about these guys in a prison. I don't know, he said, and so we went into it, and it just blew me away. I mean. I think it kind of launched. It kind of really. Morgan Freeman was around forever. He'd been around, but that I think really kind of elevated him into the stratosphere, didn't it?
Yeah. What year was it? Was it 95?
I think. Yeah. 95.
Wow. Yeah. Gosh. So it was just really the whole story was great. He was so conniving and cunning, and none of us expected it. When you first see that movie, at the end when the guy throws that little. The chess pieces at that poster, and it goes through the poster, and he suddenly realizes what's happened, and it was just brilliant.
It was Tim Robbins was coming off the back of Hudsucker Proxy, and something else, and then Shawshank Redemption came along, and it's kind of like, oh right, yeah, it's Tim Robbins again, and Morgan Freeman had done sort of stuff like Robin Hood and Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah, and he'd been like way before that. He'd been in, if you look at his career, he'd been in so many movies for such a long time.
Yeah.
You know? But it was always the end of that movie really irritated me because you could tell that it finished when he gets on the bus and he's free. And then, of course, because the audience, you know, they must have shown it to the audiences and they didn't want enough. So then suddenly there's this add-on at the end when Morgan Freeman's walking along the beach and there he is fixing some boat on some. It just didn't work.
But
that was the only bit I would criticize.
But do you think that in the film, do you think that is real, or is that an imagination, or is that a dream?
Oh, what, the very last bit? Well, I think it sort of sets it all up, doesn't it? And I think sometimes when you release movies, you do tests beforehand, and if the audience don't understand it, they'll add something on to finish it off. And I just felt that's what that was. That they were visualizing what he had in his mind already.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I had a similar experience watching. I watched it at the cinema. It came out weirdly. It was at the big Odeon cinema in Leicester Square. So they'd obviously sort of put a bit of effort into promoting it.
Yeah.
And it was in this huge auditorium. I went in there and there was about like three or four of us in the screen. And I loved it, but almost at the end of it going, I guess you won't hear about that film again. It felt a bit like that. It just felt like, you know, we're the only people that bothered to go and see it. And it just became, it totally had this sort of second life on video and stuff.
Oh, for sure. But then I had the same amazing feeling about another movie, which I was thinking about saying was my favourite, was a French film called Untouchable, about a guy in a wheelchair. And a carer comes along. I don't know if you've seen that film.
No. They remade it, didn't they?
They remade it.
Bryan Cranston and Kevin Hart.
Yeah, it was good, but not as good as the original. But but that, I mean, I'm dyslexic, so reading subtitled movies is just fucking vain. Oh no, sorry, is a real pain in the ass for me. But I sat down and it was so well made that I just watched the movie, and that was one of the first movies where the film finished and the lights came up, and I turned to my wife and I said, "Do you know, if they played that again right now, I'd just watch the whole thing again." I just love that movie. I can't stress how good that movie is as well. Apart from all the ones that I've done, which you can look online and, you know, obviously.
Yeah, they're the best ones. But, I mean, we've got to say apart from those ones. That's how apart we judge all movies.
Yes.
Apart from, what's your favourite movie? What, apart from the Charlie Borman filmography? Yeah. Oh, well, if it's not those, then probably...
I find that I watch films differently these days. When I was a kid and I was growing up, I could re-watch the same film. Well, because of video shops, I suppose, you'd rent out Three Amigos on Friday night, you'd watch it, and then you'd watch it again on Saturday morning, and then maybe a friend would come over, and then you'd watch it again. And you could watch like a film over and over again. I find that these days I'll watch a film that's really good, and I'll go, that was good. And only very rarely do I have a film that like eats away in my head where I'm like, I've got to see that again. And you know, that's really special.
I mean, it does. I mean, I travel normally when you know, if we're not all in lockdown and COVID, you know, I normally travel four or 7 months of the year doing different projects around the world. But I have like 6 or 7 movies that I really like on my phone or on my iPad, which I travel with. And so if I can't sleep, I'll turn those films on because I know them and it doesn't wake me up. So I can actually fall asleep without worrying that I've missed something, you know. So I kind of tend to have these like 4 or 5 movies that I've seen countless times, but they almost make me, you know, it makes me feel relaxed to go to sleep.
Well, I find The Empire Strikes Back is. If I put that on, I can be asleep before they've even had the battle on Hoth. Like, but because it's so white and snowy, it's kind of like it's just very relaxing to watch. Yeah. And because I know it so well, and it's one of my favourite films, that you can, there's sort of like a comfort to it. What are some of the films that you take around with you?
Oh, I take The Shawshank Redemption. I take that French film that we spoke about, Untouchable. And then I like Batman. Batman Begins. Is it Batman Begins? The one when they take over Gotham City. Or Batman. Anyway, I can't remember which one it is. But one of those. And then one that always makes me laugh is the Coen Brothers movie, which is The Big Lebowski.
Oh, yeah.
And I cannot. It just makes me laugh every time I see it. And the end of the movie, just no matter how many times I see it, I still just piss myself with laughter.
I mean, it's a perfect example of one, which is, it's one of the most rewatchable movies, I think, from the past 20 years. I can't think of a film that is more rewarding for just rewatch. And it feels like something that doesn't really happen so much. Maybe like Nick saying, maybe it's just the time of my life where I'm less likely to watch something again.
Yeah.
Whereas The Big Lebowski, I will easily watch once a year. Because it's like going and meeting some old friends or something.
Well, The Big Lebowski. I watched The Big Lebowski with my girlfriend 3 weeks ago, and she's not seen it before.
Yeah.
And she got to the end of it, and she goes, "Yeah, it's all right. the main character's a bit boring, but
well, like, that's enough just to dump her right there.
Well, you go,
that's it.
But what you said, but you know, because you've got to make your, you know, you've got to roll your sleeves up, and you've got to rehabilitate these people, and you have to say, you know, you might think it's only all right now, but when you've seen it 35 times like me, you'll love it, right?
I think there's some truth to that. I think it's rewarding. Like, if you watch it again, I think you'll get, like, if you watched it again in a little while, I reckon she might get something out of it again. You go, that bit's really funny. Oh, that
just,
bit's coming
that
up.
Dry humour and just, you know, there's just obvious when he's holding the bowling ball and he goes, "What's this?" And he says, "It's a tennis ball." or something like that.
He says, obviously you're not a golfer.
Obviously not a golfer, that's right, that's it. It's obviously so not
good.
A golfer.
It's so good, yeah. And to the bit when he's like nailing the chair to the floor to protect the door. And it takes him ages. And you go, that is one of the all-time greatest visual gags in any film that's ever been made. It's amazing.
It's
you notice something, I think we talked about this like three weeks ago, didn't we?
Yeah, probably.
But you notice something different about it every single time. And I think it took me like five viewings to realise that the entire plot is literally just about a rug.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. He just wants the rug back. It's... It's funny, you know, my father's a film director, and he directed films like Deliverance and Excalibur and Hope and Glory and a whole bunch of other big, great movies. And the Coen brothers came stayed at my dad's house in Ireland, and he's got a little cottage where dad lives in the Wicklow Mountains, and dad has written most of his scripts and produced them and edited them and directed them and all that kind of stuff. And he said he just found it fascinating. He'd go down and he'd just sit in the cottage with the brothers when they were writing and just watch them write. And one of them was on the keyboard, you know, writing away and talking about it. And the other one was pacing up and down in the room. And he said it was just incredible to be able to see two people working together, writing a script, because it's quite difficult writing, isn't it? It can often be quite a lonely thing,
it.
You know.
And I hate it.
I know. Well, especially when you're dyslexic as well. It's like, fucking hell, there's a blank page of just nothingness, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of perfect, really, because, I mean, that's almost how you want to imagine people write scripts as well. It's almost like that's how someone would write a script in a Coen Brothers film. It'd be someone chatting while someone's punching a typewriter. But you've buried the lead there, because we were going to bring up your dad, because your dad is sort of like, he's such a big movie director, and sort of historically in the history of movies, he's made so many big movies, and kind of throughout that period of like the 60s and 70s, he would be one of the biggest filmmakers in the world, really, right? There's like, and has made so many kind of classic movies like Deliverance, which I didn't realize you were in.
Yes, yeah. Well, I wasn't the banjo player, just so you know.
Or the
guy in the woods. Just, you know, just want to point that out. No, but it was interesting, because right at the end of the movie, there's a little boy sitting on the sofa, and John Boyd goes back to his wife and his family, and anyway, that's me sitting on the sofa. And my father said to me, he said, "Charlie, if you sit on that sofa with that bloke, I'll give you a tricycle." Sounded very dodgy, but you know, I wanted that tricycle. But I mean, I kind of grew up, you know, just in and out of film sets and stuff. And when you do, you know, and like any kid, you know, you're whatever your dad does, he's just your dad, you know. And you go visit him at work, and then you end up in the movie, because my father always said, he's got four children. He said, if there are children in the film, there's no point in paying child actors when you can four of mine for free. So we were always thrown in. I mean, I should have held out for points on Deliverance. I'd be a millionaire. But you know, I got a tricycle. But it was a beautiful tricycle, cherry red tricycle with yellow flames. I mean, it was, you know. And maybe that's what made me start riding motorcycles. I don't know.
Sure. And if not, you'd just be a millionaire. Sat at home.
Yeah. Exactly.
I read in one of your, like, the biography that Lee Marvin is your godfather.
Oh yes, yeah, no, Lee, no, yeah, Lee Marvin was he was over here making a movie, and he saw a film that my father did called Lear the Last with Marcello Mastroianni, and it was a very strange, odd kind of movie, and he loved it, and he approached my father and said, "Look, I want you to direct my next movie in America." And Lee Marvin was the biggest, hottest guy at the time. You know, he was the Brad Pitt or whatever you want of the time. And so Dad came over with him, and he sat down with the producers of Paramount, and he said, "Okay, this is John Borman." Then no one knew who he was, and he's the guy who's going to direct my movie. And they were all looking at Lee and Dan, and saying, "Lee, you sure?" And he goes, "No, this is the guy." So they started talking about what they were going to do. And about 2 minutes later, Lee Marvin stood up and said, "Well, I'll just leave you guys to it." And he left the room. and Dad said he always remembers it because he saw these producers standing there. And then as Lee left, they were all watching him leave. And then the door closed and they all looked back at Dad as if to say, well. But he was an amazing guy, Lee Marvin. I mean, he fought in the Second World War in the South Pacific. He was a Marine. He was, you know, his platoon were ambushed and his whole platoon were killed except for him and another guy. I mean, people don't know much, but he was actually shot in the ass. But he never really quite liked to talk about that because he was a Marine and being shot in the ass, you know, potentially means that you were running away at the time. So he never quite liked that, you know. But you know, it was a ricochet and he was down and the other guy came back and he was the only one left. And he came back, picked him up and carried him out. But he was a funny guy. I'll tell you a funny story. Have we got time?
Yes, we've got as long as you want.
So Point Blank was a huge movie. It was a massive success. Mm-hmm. If anybody likes movies out there, definitely pick it up. It's black and white, Lee Marvin, very stylized movie, and that's a little bit about like The Rug. He gets messed over by his partner, and he just wants his money back, and he just goes off systematically killing everybody until he gets his money, and it was the first sort of proper violent movie that was made with sort of proper violence. And anyway, so the film was a big success. So they were out celebrating on Malibu Pier, and there was a famous restaurant on Malibu Pier. And this is in Los Angeles on the Pacific Coast Highway, where all the, you know, where all the big houses are on the beach. And anyway, so they're eating and Lee gets really drunk which was, you know, not unusual. And anyway, so they get out of the car park and Dad's saying, look, Lee, give me the keys because I'll drive because you're drunk. And Lee wouldn't give them. So I have this tussle in the car park. And Dad grabs the keys and he runs to the car and he locks himself in the driver's seat. And my mum and my two older sisters dive into the car on the other side, along with Pam, his wife at the time. And they all close the door. Lee's screaming and shouting. And eventually he won't get in the car. And so he climbs up onto the roof of the car and he won't get off the roof of the car, right? So Dad thinks, oh, God, how are we going to get home? It's late, you know. So, and it's only down a mile down the Pacific Coast Highway, down to the colony where they were living. And so he thought, oh, I'll just drive down. So he turns onto the PCH, which I don't know how many people know, but it's a really busy road. and he's driving down the PCH and he doesn't get like 300 feet or 300 meters. And there's a police motorbike coming up the other way. And the police motorbike sees us and he flips around, puts the lights on, pulls Dad over. And he's thinking, oh, this is going to be, how am I going to explain this? And so you can imagine Lee being drunk. So he's turned all his attention to the policeman now and saying all sorts of really terrible things to the policeman. And the policeman's ignoring him. And he walks up to Dad, to the car window, and he knocks on the driver's side window. And Dad rolls down the window thinking, okay, here we go. And the policeman leans in and he goes, sir, do you realize you have Lee Marvin on the roof of your car? And my father said, well, actually, yes, I do. And he goes, that's fine, sir. Have a nice evening. And off he went.
That's great.
Do you think of him as like such a sort of tough guy actor? And I guess that's borne out in real life, but I guess there's also a very kind of sweet side to him that seeing his films now.
I don't know. No, he was a lovely guy, but he, you know, he did drink a lot. He was sometimes quite a big character. But you know, he and my father were best friends forever. And Lee died super young, really, for his talent. And you know, if it wasn't for the drink, he would have been, you know, God knows how many movies he would have made. You know, so it's such a waste of a talent. You know.
Yeah, but still, you know, still a legend now for what he did do, you know. That's interesting because I guess that really would have set up your dad's career, right? To have someone powerful to come in and say, this guy's making my next movie and he's going to tell you what it is sort of giving him such kind of freedom as well in Hollywood, which I guess would have probably started or really kickstarted his career, which, you know.
Well, that led on for my father to then went on and then did he then went on and did Deliverance and all this kind of stuff. And then he had John Boyd at the time, he was the big guy. Mm-hmm. But Reynolds was a stuntman who kind of fitted the part. And by the time the movie came out, you know, Burt Reynolds just stole the movie, you know, and then Burt Reynolds became this sort of icon, you know, but that was a great movie again for Dad. But that was interesting because, you know, that had the first male rape scene in a movie, and the producers were very worried about that, and they weren't sure if it would fly with the audience. And my father would say, look, it's the whole pivotal point of the whole movie is because of this horrible moment that everything else went crazy. Anyway, so they were coming and hiring about it. And Mary Tyler Moore at the time was a big actress at the time. And she was a real feminist and women's rights. She was a campaigner and stuff. And she heard about it and she said she wanted to watch the movie. And so Dad set up a screening for her, and she turned up with 200 women. And they all sat down and watched the movie. And then when that scene came on with Ned Beatty, you know, they all stood up and applauded. And the two producers at the back thought, right, okay, we'll keep this. So there's lots of kind of moments where somebody has believed in somebody or something has seen something and that person has influenced somebody, you know. And I suppose that's why friendship is you know, and looking after each other is so important, isn't it, you know. When you make sure that people that you love are with you, especially after what's happened recently.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that in me and Nick do stand up, and I kind of think of all the kind of relationships you make in that world, and getting to do stuff like this with Nick now, and it's that kind of making friends and essentially working with your friends is sort of the best kind of career you can have, really. And collaborating with people is always, like, I find it super satisfying. Of everything I do, I think my favorite stuff is always collaborating with friends.
Yeah. It's all right.
He's going, yeah, this is fucking getting rid of him.
This has got us through lockdown, hasn't it?
No, it has. And lucky for you guys, you know, and this whole thing about is you know, during lockdown to be able to work from home and the technology to be able to do it. You know, I mean, it's such a shame that none of us bought shares in Zoom, you know, before this started.
I mean, it was, you know, crazy.
And so, but it's totally changed the whole thing. And you realize that you can do whatever you want, wherever you want. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've got two friends who were working from home anyway. And they, at the beginning of lockdown, they went over to Croatia and rented an Airbnb in Hvar and spent the last year over there in a beautiful part of the world, and because they can work remotely. Mm. So it's perfect.
And speaking about working with friends, I guess it's a good opportunity to talk about Ewan McGregor, that you've sort of gone on all these huge kind of journeys, which again, but is that right? It is working with your mate, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Was that the initial attraction?
We met on a film set together, and I think the first conversation I ever had with Ewan was about motorbikes. So we were in Ireland, in the West Coast, and we met in some, I think, a hotel bar or something where we were all staying. And I walked up to him, and I knew he owned a motor goods in California. And I came up and said, hey, hi. And we started talking about motorbikes. And here we are, you know, almost 30 years later, still talking about motorbikes.
Which film did you meet on?
It was my comeback movie. My film career had collapsed completely. Mine was heading south. His was heading, rocketing up and all that kind of stuff. And so I got this movie, and it was Ewan McGregor, Pete Postlethwaite, Greta Scacchi, Richard E. Grant. And I'm thinking me, and I'm thinking, this is fantastic. And we had a blast making it. And then it was just a pile of shit, really. And I think it even passed. I don't think it even made to a DVD. It just went straight to the bin. But we ended up just having a blast, and the two of us just ended up staying friends. And we kind of ran motorbike race teams together a little bit, and we did just all sorts of anything to do with motorbikes. We did, and then we just started talking about doing a bit of a longer trip, and then I don't know, just suddenly we were out in the middle of Mongolia, thinking, what have we done? Why are we here? Whose fault is this? I don't want to be here at times. And then other times you're thinking this is, you know, and it just turned out to be one of the most amazing experiences. But to be able to do a trip like that with your best friend we're so lucky to be able to have done it, you know, to be able to pull it together and actually do it and to spend that kind of time out in the middle of nowhere was just fantastic. It's every person's dream, really, isn't it, to go off on an adventure.
Well, it's great. Would that have been something that you'd have done without cameras? Because I find that I did a food show where I got to travel around a bit. And then I also got my friend in, David Trent, to come in and write it with me. And we got to go to Paris together and all this other stuff. I always found that before I had a career, I didn't have any money to travel. And then when I had the career, I was so busy trying to keep hold of the career and trying to maintain the career that I couldn't go on holiday anyway. Yeah. And so when work takes you abroad and takes you around all these places, there was this thing about Christopher Plummer did this film called Star Crash, and they filmed it in Rome, and it's a terrible Star Wars ripoff. And they were like, why did you do Star Crash? And he said, because if you get a job in Rome, you do the job in Rome.
Well, that was probably where my career kind of went downhill, because I kept choosing movies for their location, and I'd be sitting on a plane reading the script, thinking, I mean, it's a great place to, fantastic place to go to, but the script is shit. So, but I mean, you know, but it's a great place. But no, but I think, you know, but that's always the no one intentionally goes out to make a bad movie, you know, and but it's just there's not that many end up being good. For sure, I think Ewan and I were going to go off and do this kind of trip anyway. I mean, I think a bit like you, by the time Ewan and I decided to do it, my acting career had gone very thin, and I spent sort of 10 years painting and decorating and doing people's houses up. And, you know, I wasn't where I was before, you know, and we decided to do this trip. And then I realized it was going to be sort of 3 months, and I was thinking, well, do you know what? I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to afford this. And then someone mentioned about a book, and they said, you know, this would make a great book, two friends going around the world, you know, perfect for a book, you know, and not knowing what's going to happen and stuff. So we kind of went that way, and then we kind of got a book deal. But then both of us thought, well, I'm really dyslexic and he's not much better than me. And we thought, well, how the fuck are we going to write this thing, you know? And then we thought we'd do like video diaries, and then we'd get someone to help us construct it, you know, afterwards, you know, and that seemed like a good idea. And then we thought, well, if we'll film that bit, then we should film a little bit of it. And then it kind of snowballed into that, really. So, you know, it was partly out of necessity, you know, in order to find the money to do it. And then it became kind of obvious.
But that's the best way round. You know, it was a legitimate thing that turned into a creative endeavor. Whereas, you know, you go, how am I going to fill 6 hours of telly? Yeah. Oh, we'll go on a trip. Do you know what I mean? You did it the right way around.
But it was a hard sell for TV, because, you know, you go to the TV stations and you sit there and we'd say, we're going to go from London to New York doing this, and we're going to, you know, lots is going to happen. And they go, well, what's going to happen? And we go, no idea what's going to happen. And they're going, well, that's not a great TV show, is it? For a book, it's fantastic, because that's the adventure of it, you know. But for a TV show, and you go to them and say, and they go, well, you know. So that was actually quite a hard sell to get it. And Sky did it in the end. But anyway, you know, that it worked out. But I think we got lucky, you know. I think, you know, it, like all these things, it's timing, isn't it? Like my dad's movies and stuff, they come out and it just hits the right time. And you know, I think people were looking for holidays, but we were right on the crest of a wave of adventure travel, you know, and adventures of people going somewhere and having an adventure rather than just sitting on a beach. And that was just starting to crest at the time. So when the TV show came out, it you know, people had an appetite for that. And it was a bit of a slow burner. It wasn't an instant success, bit like Shawshank Redemption, you know. It was a slow burner. No, but so it evolved in something. But for me, you know, and what Ewan, you know, said, look, come on, let's do this, Charlie, let's get it done. So in a way, he did for me what Lee did for Dad, you know. And I got a from doing Long Way, I ended up doing Race to Dakar, which was I did the Dakar Rally on a motorbike, and we filmed that, and then we did Long Way Down together. Then I did a whole ton of other TV shows because of that, and because of that idea, and because of you and saying, come on, let's do it. And he's such a generous guy and such a thoughtful person. You know, it's a very nice person to have, you know, on looking out for you when you're out doing these adventures. He's a very nice chap.
But yeah, that did sort of start it all off. What was it like? Because you had this career as an actor, and even though I guess if you're successful in acting, you kind of lose your anonymity that way. But almost off the back of this series, you've gone from being an actor, but now you've got this almost, you become well known for being essentially an adventurer. Was that interesting at that point to lose your, to sort of actually, that's the thing that's going to make my career. That's the thing I'll be known for now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I, you know, at the time I had 10 years of doing fuck all, really. So I wasn't really making a great deal of money. I was, you know, starting to do people's houses up. I was starting to think, you know, well, this is going to be my career. I was going to start to really focus on doing that, you know, and then this came along and it changed everything. And I think I had, in my acting career, I think I had a lot of opportunity that my youth or I didn't take hold of the opportunity that was presented at the time, you know. And I think lots of us do that. And by the time Long Way came out, I was mature enough or ready to be able to take that on. And I think partly I found a format that I really enjoyed. I really struggled as an actor learning lines because of dyslexia, and I used to find that horribly stressful. But by doing these sort of documentaries, I was unscripted and I could just talk rubbish the whole time, you know, and then hopefully that they wouldn't make me look too much of an idiot when it came to the edit, you know.
I guess this is probably a good time to talk about your latest kind of challenge, which is a 30-mile paddleboard for Movember. Tell us about that.
Well, it seemed like during heavy lockdown, it seemed like a really good idea at the time. You know, let's do 2 days. We'll do 17 miles the first day. And then the second day, we'll do 14 miles. And there were 28 locks that you have to pick the paddleboard up and go over. And yeah, it'd be great. And we'll do it in December, you know, because it's one of the most depressing times. And do it for men's health, I think love paddleboarding anyway, and it's about doing this sport together that everybody can do, you know. And it's one of those ones which is a slower pace, so you can sit and chat and stuff like that. And I think men in the past, you know, find it very difficult. You know, you'd ask your mate, how are you, and the other one would say fine, you know, and then that would be that, you know. And nowadays I think there's much more of an appetite, isn't there, to be able to sort of say, well, you know, how are you? And the other one says, well, I'm okay. No, and you say, well, really, how are you? And then you kind of actually chat, a bit like you and I did on the Long Ways, you know. And so the idea was to get a bunch of people together. So we've got, you know, we've got Jamie Hick, Haskell, and we've got James Phillips, you know, one of the Weasley twins, and Damon Hill, and Matthew Wright, and the Nick and Giles English, the guys from Bremont Watches. I don't know if you're doing that, building watches now in Henley, all rather than in Switzerland. And then Ben Bowers, who really put all this together, really. And he worked for Movember for a very long time. And he and I met because I'd lost a testicle through cancer. And my dog, the reason I found out I had testicular cancer was because my other dog, Ziggy, our first one, we went to the vet, and the last thing he checked was his nuts, and one of them felt a bit odd. And he said that one of your dog's nuts feels odd. And my wife said, Christ, one of my husband's nuts feels a bit odd. And he goes, you should definitely get that checked out. And so 4 days later, I was having my testicle taken out. And I remember lying there having the operation, and the anaesthetist was looking down at me, and the surgeon were looking down at me going, "Don't worry, Charlie, it's just like shelling peas." And I went out, and all I had in my mind was my testicle like this.
Oh,
and
they just gone
as they popped the testicle out. Anyway, so I met Ben, and he lost both his testicles, and we were both telling our story, and I met him somehow, I can't remember, and I introduced him to Movember and said, "Look, this guy's fantastic," and stuff. And so we both would go cruise around with Movember guys, JC from Movember, and we would tell our stories, and we were always introduced as Womble. So that's kind of how we met. And then he has been doing that, and he's come up with this challenge. And the idea is to get people together, to be able to chat, to be able to talk, you know, do something good for mental health and all that kind of stuff. So
were you a massive paddleboarder before you started doing this?
I kind of all last lockdown, you know, remember we had that blissful summer. And my wife is a big paddleboarder, Olivia. And then I started paddleboarding with her. And then we would just do sections of the Thames all through the summer. And I just really got into it. I just love it. It's my dog gets on the paddleboard with me, and he sits on the paddleboard. And, you know, I'm so looking forward to all the pubs being open, because the best thing that we used to do was you'd paddle up to a pub, have a few pints, and then you'd paddle down river because it was easier, and have a swim, and that was that, and a burger, because, you know, you'd worked out, so that was okay.
And this is all taking place on the 17th. So is that...
Yes.
It's a week or two away from now.
Yeah, it's a week or two away from now. It's on the Basingstoke Canal, and we've got 2 days. And so the first day is 17 miles, second day is 14 miles with 28 locks. We did a practice paddleboard, and I smashed my legs up really badly about 4 years ago, and I had to learn to walk again and all this kind of stuff. And so when I'm standing still for a long time, when I get to the side, we had a practice taking the boards out on this lock and going down, and it was so cold that all my legs had frozen up. So I was practically crawling with my paddleboard to the next bit to get into the water. So I don't know what it's going to be like with 28. Maybe I'll play that, you know, I'm really injured card, and I'll bring my little blue badge with me. And
don't you dare.
Sympathy.
Don't you dare.
James Haskell, have you seen the size of him? I mean, he could carry me and the board and his board without even batting an eyelid, you know?
Sure.
See if you can get him to do that.
Is this the furthest you'd have gone in one go?
Yeah, I think in one go for sure. Yeah, normally I can't go too far because my ankle and stuff is all messed up. So it's quite painful to stand for a long time. But you know, I've got all these people around me, and I've got Amy from Virgin. She's going to be there as well, and Damon's very funny. You know, Damon Hill, who was a Formula One champion. He's really funny and just takes the piss out of everybody the whole time. So it'd be great fun. It's going to be. You guys should come with us. Why don't you come with us? It's a long time. Fuck that.
Well, you know, I have been actually putting this off, but like, so what is paddleboarding?
Standing on a surfboard and paddle. That's about it, really.
Yeah, that's really what I thought it was. Easy. That's what I thought it was. Do you know what? If it was on dry land, you might get me.
Maybe we could meet you at one of the pubs.
Yeah, come meet us at the end. That'd be great. And you can get the champagne out. You know?
I could do that. We can applaud and we could do that bit.
Yeah, exactly.
And how do people, so you're raising money for Movember. How do people give money or how do they help out?
Yeah, well, they can go, and if they go to if you go to Movember.com and then you can find the link there, and it's called the Big Stand Up, and you can donate there, and all the money goes to great health. I mean, Movember was originally about, it started because of mates of theirs had testicular cancer, and a bunch of them in Australia decided to grow a beard. Grow a mustache for the month of November, and it kind of caught on, and they did it again the next year. But because of their money, my testicular cancer, they changed the way they treat it. And so for me, when I had my testicle taken out and stuff, I it was because of the Movember money and how they did it that saved my life. So
that's amazing.
I'm always very grateful for them.
I guess that's important to say as well, because that's certainly my understanding of it as a charity. I always think of it as it's a one-time deal. People grow a moustache in November, and the rest of the year, I guess, you don't really think about it. So I guess it's important for them to do stuff all year round.
Yeah, like it's definitely important for them. And they raise hundreds of millions of pounds. It's unbelievable the success of what they've done. And they don't just do cancer now, but they do. It's all about men's health as well. And because, you know, women are fantastic at you know, with breast cancer and talking and you know, going to the doctors and making sure that everything is okay. Mm-hmm. And men are just useless. I mean, I remember my doctor said, you've got to get that testicle checked out. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. And to get an ultrasound is, what's that woman in the belly when you look at
ultrasound.
And he said, you've got to have that done. You've got to as soon as possible. And I said, yeah, fine, I'll do it. And then I just didn't bother.
Yeah, anyway,
the next morning at 8:30 in the morning, he rang me up. And in 20 years of being in that practice, they've never rung me. And he, the doctor personally rang me and said, Charlie, have you had that ultrasound yet? And I'm no, but I'm going to do it now. He completely freaked me out. And then my sister, Talsha, 25 years ago, she had ovarian cancer and she lost her life to ovarian cancer. And so I kind of knew, you know, that last year of my sister's life was pretty horrendous for her. So there was all that was sort of swimming around in my mind as well. And so, but luckily the doctor said, look, Charlie, this is an inconvenience, not a life changer. So get it done, you know.
And I guess like,
so, and I had a false one put in. So he said, do you want a false one put in? And I said, what do you mean false one? I said, you can have false ones put in. He goes, yeah, you can. Just a little silicon thing goes in. And I said, well, is it common? You know, and I wasn't sure what to do. And he goes, well, it's about 50-50. So that wasn't any help for the decision. And then I asked my wife and she said, yeah, no, you definitely have one as long as it's bigger than the last. I think she was thinking about the wrong thing. I'd already asked the doctor about that. And he said, you need something to graft onto if you want that done. But anyway, I didn't. So, I had a testicle put in. And if you have testicular cancer and you lose a nut, don't have a false one put in, because it just gets in the way, because it's sewed to your ball bag, and so if you do high activity, your nuts will come up into your body and get out the way, whereas this bloody silicon thing just stays down there. So when I'm doing motocross and stuff like that, I often sit on it because it gets in the way, and then it pulls, and then it's really painful, and then you know, it's just a nightmare. So you know, if you're going to lose a nut, just lose a nut, and
that's,
you know,
fascinating.
Be proud of it.
Do you know what?
That's great advice
that I've never thought of.
I've never heard anyone say that, and that is
touch
incredible.
Wood. It never happens, but now I mean, it's happened. a good bit of advice.
But as Movember would always say, and I think you know, please do give generously to the big stand up, because you know all of that kind of money goes in men's health and mental health. But for what you, the most important thing to do is you must make sure that you get to know your nuts. And you know, whenever you have a shower or whatever it is, or stand in front of your partner and you know, get them to feel your nuts and you feel their bits, and you get to know each other's bits, and it's great, and you do it once a week, and it's great, and then that way you catch it early, and that's the way to do it.
Of course, yeah. And I guess that's interesting. You're saying again about that the Movember also support kind of men's mental health is what we're touching on a minute ago, where you were just talking about
for sure.
Men kind of talking to each other and asking if they're all right and trying to be kind of supportive. And I guess that's another thing. I mean, the old joke about testicular cancer was like, it's rare that men don't find themselves holding their balls when they're left alone anyway. But I guess it's a good thing to have a kind of to have a feel about, especially if you're in the bath or whatever.
Yeah, no, but you'd be surprised at how many people, you know. You know, I spoke to someone who said, no, I'll never do that. And I'm thinking, but yeah, no, it is really important. So, you know, I want you guys, you know, tonight, tomorrow morning when you have your shower, grab a handful, get to know your nuts.
Charlie, after the last year, I'm sick of the sight of mine. So and going back to influences a little bit, are you aware that part of the Batman mythos now is that Bruce Wayne's parents came out of the cinema while Excalibur was on?
Oh, that'd be brilliant if it was. Because I was in that movie, so it would.
I was watching it last night.
If that was the case, the psychologically, then you know I technically was in Gotham.
Well, yeah. That's the thing, because
I mean that's a stretch, but
I think Excalibur is Zack Snyder's favorite film.
I heard that. Yeah.
He put it in the cinema. I'm not sure if they're watching it or if they're still watching Zorro, but it's on at the cinema because it gives you a time. A place in time.
Yeah.
So they put it in the cinema on Batman versus Superman. And then when they did Joker, which has nothing really to do with Batman versus Superman, Excalibur is on at the cinema in Joker as well.
Wow. That's so cool. How nice is that? I've forgotten. I seem to sort of remember, but that is kind of cool, isn't it? That, but, you know, that was a funny story about that. So I was in the movie. And I was, I don't know, 12 or 13 years old. I can't remember. And I had a full set of gold armor. I was young Mordred, the evil son of King Arthur. And anyway, so I did the movie. And then we go to Cannes. And there's a big success in Cannes Film Festival. And we go to the theater. And there's crowds of people. And everyone's shouting your name. And it's like, wow, this is amazing. And and I sat to watch the movie. And then when I came on... it wasn't my voice. It was my sister's voice, Talcha. And I'm going, and I look at my father, and I go, why's my sister's voice instead of mine? And he went, shut, I'll tell you later. I'm absolutely gutted here. I've got my sister's voice. Anyway, it turns out that I tried to do the
voiceover, but Panna wasn't very good at it. And so
at the time I was absolutely gutted by that, but because, you know, years later, when my sister died, you know, 25 years ago, you know, I sometimes watch that movie and I come on, but it's her voice and it's actually quite lovely now, but at the time I was absolutely gutted, but now I love it. It's funny, you know, if you lose someone to cancer or whatever, you know, or you lose your sister, your siblings, or your parents, you know, it's funny. You never quite ever kind of get over it, and you know, you like talking today, you know, just her name always comes up, you know, at least two or three times a week, you know, I think about her and stuff. So so you know, I think that's why I'm so you know passionate about what we're doing in a few weeks' time, you know, with this big stand up to. Mm. To get people talking and get people to go to hospital, you know. I mean, if I'd been lazy and ignoring it all, you know, I would have been in a lot more trouble with my cancer. So,
it's a really lovely idea.
I think that's also amazing.
When someone dies, you often think about you might have photographs and things, but it's so rare you would have a recording of a voice, which is such a sort of emotive and powerful thing that often when people die, it just goes, and you don't have tapes and things. You might have, maybe you'd have a bit of video somewhere, but it's such a thing you kind of lose, isn't it?
And it's funny, I still have a telephone number on my phone. I still can't delete it. I just somehow can't do it. So it's still there. And I don't really see it that often. Sometimes you flick through and then you sort of see it, and, you know, anyway, but there you go.
That's amazing. Thank you. We've come to the end. Thank you so much for talking to us. We do have time to play our internationally famous game, Better or Worse.
Okay.
So I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel to take over for this bit. Nathaniel, take it away.
Okay, Charlie, this game is Better or Worse, and you just have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based on my own opinion to score points. Does that make sense? Beginning with Norman Wisdom.
Norman Wisdom.
Yeah.
Is better. Well, oh, go on.
Is Eric Clapton better or worse than Norman Wisdom, according to me?
Well, I don't know. Because Norman Wisdom did the TT movie, you know, and he crashed through that pub. No, worse, I would say. Yeah, for sure.
I'd say he's better. I'd say Norman Wisdom's better.
Better than Eric Clapton.
Than Eric Clapton.
Okay. See, this is from Nat's point of view.
It's my point of view, you see. Okay. Nick Cave. Right. Nick Cave, better or worse than Eric Clapton?
Better.
Ooh, better.
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 Bono, better or worse than Nick Cave?
Worse.
I've got a good story about him. We've got time afterwards.
Oh, tell us after. Smokey Robinson, better or worse than Bono?
Better.
Better. Tina Turner, better or worse than Smokey Robinson?
Better.
I'd say worse, but it's...
You're mad, Nathaniel!
Can't you do, like, that Zoom thing and just cut him off at this point?
It's crazy!
Britney Spears, better or worse than Tina Turner?
Worse.
Celine Dion, better or worse than Britney Spears?
Worse.
Lulu, better or worse than Celine Dion?
I've got a thing for Lulu. Definitely better. Yeah.
Better. Otis Redding, better or worse than Lulu?
Better.
Adele, better or worse than Otis Redding?
Oh, high cards.
Those are aces and kings right there. You know, I'd say she's better.
I'd say worse.
It's
a good score, though, I think.
What have we got? You got seven. Okay, you got seven. You're just below bang average.
Right. Okay, so Bono, every time he does a world tour, he goes back and he does the last concert in Dublin, right?
Right.
And anyway, so he comes on stage, and this particular year, he's doing a lot of work with UNICEF, and he comes on and he's clicking his fingers, and he says, every time I click my fingers, a baby dies in the world, right? And it's all very somber. And then in the audience, some guy shouts out, he goes, well, stop clicking your fucking finger. and put him in a bad mood for the rest of the concert.
Oh, wow.
Perfect. Yeah, so there you go.
On that note, that's all we've got time for. I normally do like a rundown, but like we've got about 50 people. I think we're going to start a new set of Better or Worse next week. So you've done fine. You're in good company. You're in there with Richard Herring, James King, Ludi Lin, Henry Normal, Janet Varney, and Johnny Vegas with seven. So it's not a terrible...
Not bad. Not terrible. It's not great, but not terrible. You know.
Good people.
I mean, good people. Yeah.
Good people.
Yeah, you've done fine. So thank you very much, Charlie, for coming on.
Thank you. No worries.
Talking to us. Thank
and
you, Nathaniel.
Give some money to the paddle boat challenge, which is on. You can find details on
the big stand up,
which you can find out on Movember.
That's right. Yeah, the big stand up from Movember. Yeah, please do. It saved my life.
It's called the big stand up.
The big stand-up, because you're standing up on a paddleboard.
Yeah, but there's no element of stand-up comedy to it.
Well, just the fact that you can stand up. In fact, when we were doing a practice the other day, I was the one who was supposed to be the guy who could do it really well, and we went all the way down on the Thames and came back up again, and about 20 feet from the end, I just went, just hit the water so hard, absolutely. And belly flopped into the water 20 feet from the end, and all the guys with us were just roaring with laughter and going, oh, you're supposed to be the professional, and it was just so embarrassing.
So yeah, so you don't, right, you, well, why don't you your
come
own comedy
and why don't you come and do the stand-up for us, because it's hours, 8 hours at a time, and you know, we'd appreciate that.
I was thinking the last thing that you really... I was thinking, wouldn't it be a good idea? So at the end of all of that, you have a treat at the end of the day where there's a stand-up gig for you to get to. And then I thought, actually, that's probably the last thing that you want. You want to just talk amongst yourselves and have a drink. You don't want a comedian to try and, I don't know, top the day that you've had by giving you a bit... You know, so it's fine. It's fine. Anyway, thank you. Thank you again for coming.
All right.
Okay, no problem. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, everybody. Look after yourselves. We're nearly there. We're not there yet. Stay, keep being safe. And can you write some actual fan mail for us? It sounds awful begging for it. But just write some actual decent fan mail for us, and we'll talk about it next week. Right, thanks very much, everyone. Goodbye.
All right, goodbye.